You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org. This episode is brought to you by Bento Box and Clover, working together to provide restaurants with even more technology for a better hospitality experience. Visit getbento.com/better to learn more.
Today's program is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Well, hello. Welcome to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer, and it is Friday, November 4th, 2022. And this is our 338th episode of this series, which is dedicated to behind-the-scenes talent in the hospitality industry. Today, we are doing a special episode in honor of the late and legendary Gail Green, who sadly passed away this past Tuesday at our home in Manhattan. Gail was 88 years old, and the cause was cancer. So today, as a tribute to Gail, we're going to rebroadcast my episode 150 with Gail Green, otherwise known as the Insatiable Critic, which originally aired on August 2nd, 2017. I was incredibly honored to have Gail on my show, as she was truly an icon in the hospitality industry. Gail was the original restaurant critic of New York Magazine for four decades, beginning in 1968, the year of the magazine's inception. And she reinvented the art of the restaurant review with sass and sensuality. She was famous for many things, including her taste, her elaborate hat collection, and her intimacies, as well as her incredible work in the restaurant community, serving up until her passing as chairwoman of City Meals on Wheels, a New York charity she helped create in the early 1980s to provide food for the elderly. Personally, I'm very saddened by this news, and I send my sincerest condolences to Gail's friends, family, and community. I feel very fortunate and grateful that I had the opportunity to know Gail a bit through my work as a culinary and hospitality publicist with my restaurant clients, as well as a podcaster. It was a true privilege having her on this show, and I'm really thankful that she took the time to share her story or stories with me and with us. So I'm going to keep this brief. I'm just going to share one of my own stories that is special. I was able to attend in 2017 the City Meals on Wheels annual power lunch at the Rainbow Room in New York City, and I had the opportunity to sit next to Gail during this luncheon. So the way seating goes at this gala is it's a random draw, and I happened to draw the table of Gail's and sit next to her. And on my other side was Florence Fabricant. So you could say it was a restaurant publicist's dream. And I was very, very lucky to be there and have this table assignment. So it was an amazing luncheon and memory that I will always hold very dear to my heart. So that's all I will say today. I will let this special past All in the Industry show speak for itself. I hope you enjoy listening back. I will truly miss Gail and her writing and her wit and her style. And again, I'm very grateful that I had the opportunity to know her and have her on this show. So thank you, Gail. Rest in peace. You will forever be the Insatiable Critic. Here's our episode 150. Hello, welcome to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer, and we are coming to you live from Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. It is Wednesday, August 2nd, 2017. This is the 150th episode of this series. Hard to believe we got to 150 here. Woo! Thanks for that, David. And yes, this show is dedicated to behind-the-scenes talents in the hospitality industry. Today, my guest is a legendary restaurant critic, and I will introduce her fully in a moment. First, as I do on every show, I will start out with my PR tip, and then later we will have my speed round game, industry news discussion, solo dining experience, and the final question. As the founder of Bayer Public Relations, I'm going to tip the show off with my PR tip of the week. Today's tip is to have a signature style. What makes you, you? How do you set yourself apart from the rest? What makes you unique and happy? Discover the true you and your own authentic sense of style and live it with a passion, as being real is fabulous. That's my tip today. Now, I am thrilled to have my guest calling in. It is the insatiable critic, Gail Green. In her role as restaurant critic of New York Magazine from 1968 to 2002, Gail helped change the way New Yorkers and many Americans thought about food. Gail also co-founded City Meals on Wheels along with James Beard, making a significant impact in New York City, rallying food world peers to make a commitment to help feed the city's homebound elderly. Gail has written many books, including her memoir, Insatiable Tales from a Life of Delicious Excess, and she has received numerous awards, including Humanitarian of the Year by the James Beard Foundation, winner of IACP's Magazine Writing Award, and a silver spoon from Food Arts Magazine. So welcome, Gail.
Well, quite an introduction.
Well, wait, I narrowed it down. It was I could have gone on for much longer, but you have quite a career and accomplished a lot.
Definitely a life of good times and indulgence.
Yes, definitely. And so in a longer bio, I did read that you grew up in Michigan, and I believe you went to the University of Michigan. Is that correct? I am a grad myself, so go blue. I did not know that. You went there.
Right, in the prehistoric times.
No.
And I worked for the Michigan Daily.
Oh, wow.
Yes, starting when I was a freshman, I began to hang out in the at the Daily office and editing, proofreading. I wasn't even on the staff. Nobody knew who I was or what I was doing, but I wanted to be involved. So I proofread, and then ultimately, when I was eligible to go on staff, I became a reporter and then an editor.
Oh, so it began back in college. That's awesome.
Well, actually, it began in high school.
Okay.
Yes, we had a high school newspaper, and I was a reporter. I decided to do a story on the boy with the green hair. I decided to find out how our high school would react if someone came to class with green hair. So I dyed my hair green, and they went insane. I got sent home, of course. It was a wonderful little story, and I guess I just became... It seemed to me this was a lovely way to make a living, if I could get a job once I got out of school.
Right. So what did you do once you graduated? Did you move right to New York and seek jobs?
No, I wasn't in New York. I was in Detroit.
Okay.
I grew up in Detroit. My family lived outside of Detroit. And I came to New York every 3-day weekend and tried to get a job, and it was very discouraging. No jobs for women at Time Inc. or the many newspapers that I tried. Finally, I heard that the New York Post would give a 1-week tryout to anybody, and that's how they staffed the paper during summer vacations when their people were taking time off. So I came in, and they said, sure, you can come. You could come for a week. You can have a tryout for a week. So I unfortunately had not worked long enough at that point for UPI in Detroit, so I quit and went to New York for my 1-week tryout.
Wow. And then what happened after the 1 week was up?
Well, they they liked my work. I got some front page stories. They asked me to stay for a 2-week tryout and then for a month tryout. At the end of the month, they said, okay, now we're going to give you 3 months. I said, no, I'm not going to take a 3-month tryout. If you don't want to hire me now, I'm going to go to Italy because the men are wonderful, and I'm going to spend the rest of my life in Italy.
I so love having you me, think,
I
okay.
I never got to spend that much time in Italy again, although I did go often with my husband and occasionally wrote about it for New York Magazine.
Which is a great segue into how did you get involved with New York Magazine? And you did not initially start, I don't believe, as the food reporter. So how did you get into writing about food and becoming the reviewer?
Well, I was always interested in food and restaurants. I was the brave eater in my family, where there were a bunch of little sort of very timid eaters. And my husband and I, Don Forst, the newspaper man, went occasionally. We heard about 3-star restaurants. We didn't know anything about it, but we heard there was such a thing as a 3-star Michelin restaurant, and we headed for La Pyramide near Lyon in the town of Vienne. We had the most extraordinary dinner, and when we staggered out of that restaurant, leaning into each other to go back to the residence, I thought to myself, I have to find a way to finance meals like this. It was 45 francs, if you can imagine. I think that's $7 at that time.
Okay.
45 francs, and of course we had some wine. One wine bottle was $1, and then we had a half bottle that was 20. The sommelier almost fainted when somebody ordered a expensive wine like that. So that was it. I was looking for places to sell articles so I could finance my passion here. And Don was very much in love with eating out, too. We would whenever we saved enough money, we would go to great restaurants in New York. Our favorite was the Café Chauvron. You probably haven't heard about it. I mean, who
would
know?
Well, now I have.
But anyway, on my website, I have a wonderful piece on the Café Chauvron and about those early days. Actually, writing for New York came much later because New York didn't start until 1968, and we were already addicted. Café Chauvron as Love Object. I published that in September 1969.
I'm going to go to your site right after this show is over and read that because I'm very curious.
I was eating around, and I was a cook. I took cooking classes, and somehow Clay Felker, I went to Clay Felker to sell him an article on Henri Soule, the famous chef, little 5 foot by 5 feet wide, 5 feet high. The famous owner of Le Pavillon. It was the greatest restaurant in New York at the time. Craig Claiborne was mad about it. I can't think of his first name, had written a whole book about the Pavillon. And I decided that I would try to write a story and sell it. So I persuaded the Ladies' Home Journal, a most unlikely place. But they had a New York section, a special New York section in the back of the magazine to run my my piece. Whoops, I'm sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. I sold it to Clay Felker first, I guess. Clay Felker was running a magazine at the Herald Tribune called New York. My husband worked for the Herald Tribune. When the newspaper folded, Clay bought the rights to the name, and 2 or 3 years later, after trying to raise the money and finally finding a backer, he started New York Magazine in spring of 1968. And after he hired all the important people, Gloria Steinem and Jimmy Breslin and
Yeah.
All the name people that gave to Lisa, all the people, the name people that
right.
were, and Tom Wolfe, that were writing incredible pieces at that time. They started in Esquire, where Clay knew them, and he brought a lot of those great writers to New York Magazine. And finally, in the middle of the summer, he began to think about a food writer, and he called.
So what was the beginning, like, I mean, being with the magazine for a long time and doing multiple reviews, I mean, it's how were your reviews back then different from today, and how did the dining, or if they were different, and also, like, what were big changes in the dining scene that you saw? I mean this question we probably could answer the whole show, because you probably saw so many changes, but what were your initial, you know, takes on restaurants, and how did it change over the years?
Well, in the beginning, there was not a lot of excitement and originality in the restaurants of New York. There were some old classics and a lot of typical steakhouses. The greatest restaurants in New York were considered to be the great French restaurants, because Craig Claiborne adored all the French restaurants. And there were, on the Upper East Side, there were a lot of Eastern European restaurants, Czechoslovakian and Hungarian, mm-hmm. and little inexpensive places, wonderful little restaurants like that. But what happened eventually was that in the late 70s, three restaurants opened that were run by young American couples who were not trained. And they were the Quilted Giraffe by Barry and Susan Wine, Chanterelle by you know who.
Right.
And the Dodin Buffon by a couple who had had a restaurant in Boston, the Pritzkers, Bobby and Karen Pritzker. And they were, all three of them, fabulous and different. They didn't use the crummy French rolls that the great French restaurants used, because they had to buy something French. They used real bread that they got in Hoboken. And all three of them actually tried to be French, because that was the thing at that time, yeah. was to be a great French restaurant. And it just changed the way we thought about food. It got many people interested and excited about food. It suggested that it was a good thing to be a chef, and it was okay to, it wasn't exactly a blue-collar job. It was, you know, it was, if your son said he was going to the Culinary Institute, you didn't commit suicide. It was almost as good as if he was going to Harvard.
Right.
So that was the beginning of people's awareness, and it began to build, and New York Magazine had a crucial role in making people aware of what fun, what theater eating in New York restaurants could be.
Yes, I'm thinking.
So that was the change.
Yeah, that was David Waltuck. It just came to me.
Right, David and Karen Waltuck.
So when you were reviewing, did you always try to be anonymous? Did you?
Oh, yes, yes, okay. Yes. When Clay Felker offered me the job, I said no, I couldn't afford to write for New York Magazine. They were paying nothing compared to the incredible fees I was getting from Cosmopolitan and Ladies' Home Journal. But I said, then when finally he said how people were fighting to become the New York Magazine restaurant critic so they could charge all their meals to the magazine, I thought, oh my God, what a concept. Okay, I accepted. But I made him promise that we would have all the same rules as Craig Claiborne, a minimum of three visits, that we would always pay the bill.
Mm-hmm.
And that we would be anonymous. And he agreed. Whatever, he said, you know. Of course.
How difficult.
So that was it. And for quite a while, I didn't reveal in any of my reviews that I was a woman. Because there was quite a prejudice against women. Craig, being a male critic, was obviously, you know, the Godfather and so important, and, you know, set a tone. So I was trying not to even be anonymous in that way. And it was only in 1974 when my darling husband and I decided we couldn't stay together any longer, that I thought, gee, here's a chance to advertise. So I did an article about a French restaurant where I imagined that I saw all kinds of wonderful illicit couples having dinner, lunch and dinner, and I revealed that I was a woman and hoped for the best. So.
Was there a big reaction from it when people found out you were a woman?
No, at that point, okay. New York Magazine was so important and so influential. Mm-hmm. And people were very excited about this new form of reviewing restaurants. That it was too. I couldn't be destroyed at that point.
Right.
They were already very. I had a huge following. Clay Felker used to come back from lunch and tell me what people were saying about my reviews. He was really thrilled. He loved writers and he loved writing.
Were you ever, or have you ever been concerned about writing negative reviews, or, you know, I don't know. Does that come in mind when you're putting together a story?
I was concerned that I could close a restaurant. And when I went to a little place that was not very good, it didn't seem to me there was any point in smashing it with a hammer because it would disappear on its own because it wasn't very good. But when a very big, popular, or hot kind of a restaurant was, the food was terrible, or the service was outrageous, the attitude was worth revealing, I felt that I must and I should, and that's it. So I finally got the courage to be very negative and occasionally was. But my goal has always been, and it still is, I'm still reviewing restaurants on my website, insatiablecritic.com. And my goal is to find a restaurant that is really worth recommending. So again and again, the restaurants, I don't want to waste a week review on two or three restaurants that aren't so good or that even are bad if they're not, not really important. I want to tell you someplace that's worth going, worth saving your money, and that's still what I'm doing now.
Yes, and I love that. And on that note, we're going to take a little break, and then we're going to talk more with Gail, so stay with us. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. With over 70% of diners researching restaurants online before they go in person, a strong digital presence is more important than ever. Bento Box's website, marketing tools, and commerce platform help restaurants get discovered online, make more money, and engage diners in person and virtually. And Clover's world-class POS and payment system streamlines daily operations for a totally seamless experience. With Bento Box and Clover working together, restaurants now have an all-in-one solution that makes it easy to deliver better hospitality from the kitchen to tableside and beyond. Bento Box and Clover, the right recipe for hospitality. Visit getbento.com/better to learn more. That's getbento.com/BETTER.
Welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Bayer. My guest today is Gail Green of Insatiable Critic, and she is the former restaurant critic at New York Magazine. I assume all my listeners know who you are, and I'm so honored to have you on my show today. I just have to say that. Another thing that you have spent a lot of time on and is very admirable is your work with City Meals on Wheels, which you co-founded with James Beard. So how did that come about? I saw it started in 1981.
Yes. There was an article in the New York Times. It was a Sunday. I was having breakfast in bed, and I read City Scrimps to Feed the Aged. It was all about how the government funds would only cover a delivery of a lunch 5 days a week to New York City's homebound elderly, and that there was nothing at all on the weekends or on holidays, and there were maybe 14 city holidays in which people might not get a meal for 3 days. And I thought, this is outrageous. And I called James Beard, and he had read the same article, and I said, you know, Jim, let's fill some Christmas baskets. And he said, well, what about weekend meals? I said, oh, we'll do that too. You know, we were so naive, we had no idea. So over the weekend, he called Barbara Kafka and various other people in the food world, restaurateurs, publicity people, people, the Food Society members. We both got on the phone, and over the weekend we raised $35,000. On Monday, I looked in the article for where to call, and there was something called Meals on Wheels. I dialed, and their number was busy. Impatiently, I looked in the article again, and I found New York City Department for the Aging. So I called them, and I said, we have $35,000 and some Cooking Good chickens. My boyfriend at the time did advertising for the chicken company. I said, we want all this money to go just for meals, because there had been a scandal recently about money being raised at a cancer benefit in which the benefit cost more than the money they raised. And the commissioner, who was put on the phone by the woman who answered, who was a schoolmate of mine at the Michigan Daily, said, of course, we have our administrative funds, and we don't have to. I said, you can't spend a dime for a stamp or phone call. Every penny must go just for meals. You have to promise. She said, I promise. There's no problem. We had administrative funds. So that weekend, they did a Christmas meal for 6,000 people.
Wow. It's incredible.
And we were so moved by what we had done that we decided to organize and continue. And, of course, they were a little nonplussed. They couldn't even cash our checks. They didn't have the capacity in a city office to cash a private check. But they had someone working there called Marcia Stein, and she took the checks to one of the centers, and they gave her the money, and she told the mayor, Koch. She said, Mayor Koch, I want you to know what's happening, and because this isn't even legal. And he said, take their money. So they took our money, and we organized, and they had a friends board, and we did events. And the first event, I think, raised $50,000. Today, we have a couple events where we raise almost $1 million, and our total is $19 million a year to feed, I think we have 18,500 homebound elderly now, and we are bringing them meals 7 days a week. Sometimes there's a double-up meal delivered on Friday or Saturday. And holidays they get meals delivered. Other holidays they get boxes of meals equivalent to a weekend of meals. Or in the winter we send emergency backpack packages of the equivalent of 10 meals that they can have food in the house in case there's a storm and their delivery person can't get through.
That's amazing. And I know you have very notable chefs involved, like Danielle Ballou, going door-to-door. And also your annual events that I'm familiar with. I know you have the Chef's Tribute at Rockefeller Center and a power lunch you do. And it's just as it's developed and grown over the years, and such incredible
work. We started with chefs on our board. Mm-hmm. Charlie Palmer and Drew Nieporant are on our board. And David Rockwell is on our board. Other, you know, the
right.
Food world people, many of those people on our board brought us other chefs. when Danielle came on. Danielle has been actually working for City Meals almost since the beginning, since he came to New York doing events, closing the restaurant to do a party, giving a table for our corporate dine out. And he was elected to be the co-president of City Meals on Wheels with Bob Grimes. And he's created something called the Chef's Culinary Council. They get together to produce events about food and sustainable fish and mm-hmm. other subjects of interest to food world people. And he has also in interested dozens and dozens of chefs in doing a meal, maybe 200 lunches, which are delivered to a particular neighborhood near the restaurant or in Brooklyn or in Harlem, depending on where the restaurant, where the particular group of people is or where the chef is located. And the chef goes out then with 10 or 12 meals, 20 meals, and delivers in person and meets the people that we're feeding. And when they actually come to meet these people, it is so touching and so moving to see how grateful they are and the way they live and how much it means. Or maybe some of them just to have a person in their home. You know, well, I used to be a cook, someone will say. I was an artist. I did PR. I never thought I would need that I would be unable to go down the steps.
Yeah, no, it's
really
wonderful.
Has been really inspiring for many other chefs. Been a very creative president of City Meals. But we've just grown and grown, and the volunteers have grown. We have many volunteers who deliver on the weekends, every single weekend. They come with their children, and children go too. It's and we have a young professional group, which is very active. We consider they're going to be our board members any minute.
Yes. Shout out to Lauren Bloomberg. I know she's a friend of mine, and I know she's your friend, too, and works on that. So,
yes, she and her husband have both been very active.
Yeah. No,
and,
terrific.
Of course, Restaurant Associates has been doing that event in Rockefeller Center Garden for 31 or 2 years. And Nick Valenti, every year it becomes more expensive to close the restaurants and donate that space and time. And his daughter has been very active also on the young professionals. So it's exciting to see. And people, you know, the reason that New Yorkers, I think, responded was the idea that it was doable. You know, mm-hmm. we were not going to create pie in the sky or cure a disease. We were just going to deliver a lunch to somebody on your block, invisible because they don't get out anymore.
Right.
And the fact that every dollar you give goes only for meals has also been very, as I told the commissioner, not a dime for a stamp or a phone call. We raise our administrative funds separately, and every dollar the public, gives, or every ticket you buy, that money goes only for creating and delivering the meals.
Yeah, no, and much credit to you for founding the organization and staying with it all these years. It's really quite impressive and inspiring, and.
Well, nobody can say I'm not obsessive.
No, they can't. Okay, we need to take another break. But before we do, I want to ask you my question from my last guest. So in episode 149, I had on Evan Sung. He's a prominent food, lifestyle, and travel photographer. His work is amazing. So his question is, you've seen a lot of changes in the restaurant world, and sometimes it's easy to think about the good old days and how things might have been better before, such as noise level and comfort. But there are things that you see in restaurants these days. But are there things in restaurants that you see these days that you applaud, such as new developments that you think are really great compared to the past?
Well, I think that the continuing creativity of chefs and the different complexity of some restaurants, the return to simplicity at times, mm-hmm. And then the continued generosity to the community. Restaurants, owners and chefs seem to me particularly to be extremely community spirited. All of that is, I consider to be wonderful developments.
Yeah, I like that answer a lot. And on that note, we're going to take another break, and then we're going to come back and play my speed round game and talk some industry news. So stay with us. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential small hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Hi, I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past here on Heritage Radio Network. Using food as a lens to observe history and culture, I take you on a weekly journey through different topics of culinary history. Tune in on Thursdays at noon to hear about the history of such topics as American cake, the accidental churning of butter, pho, the Vietnamese soup craze, and so much more. And help us keep this and other Heritage programming alive. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to donate. And continue enjoying great programs.
And we're back. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Bayer. My guest today is insatiable critic Gail Green. It's time for my speed round game. So, Gail, what this is I'm going to name a few things, giving you a choice, and you pick your preference. Are you ready?
Pick my preference.
Such as chocolate or vanilla. That's an example.
Chocolate.
Okay. That was a test. Good job. All right, now, here. And I'm chocolate, too. Okay, so here we go. Eat in or eat out?
Eat out.
Wine, beer, cocktail, or mocktail?
Say that again.
Wine, beer, cocktail, or mocktail?
Red wine. Red. Wine is red.
Okay. How about tasting menu or a la carte?
A la carte. I'm tired of tasting menus at the moment.
Yeah. Okay. How about small plates or large plates?
It doesn't matter. Whatever it is, I would love to share with everyone at the table and have more plates.
I love it. Communal table or chef's counter?
I like chef's counter a lot because it's fun to watch them work.
Yeah, I agree. Tipping or all-inclusive charge?
A tipping. It gives you a chance to be generous, and when you're occasionally angry, you can show it.
Okay. How about vintage handbags or hats?
Well, I would certainly love a $2,000 handbag. That's never been my style. But I have a collection of antique evening bags that I have been selling on Etsy. So that was my madness.
Well, I follow you on Twitter, and I see you consistently post about selling these bags. I'm thinking, you have a lot of bags.
Right. I had no idea how many I had till I started selling them on Etsy. And then I started opening more drawers and more drawers and adding on. But I think I don't know actually if it would really be that wonderful to have a Gucci bag or what are these? The two, Jane, what's her name bag? Because they're very militant looking. They're giant and they're heavy, and I think they're too heavy for most women to carry.
Right.
I like a clutch bag actually that goes under your arm, and I love having more and more and more. So If they're not too expensive, that's wonderful, too. Oh, hats.
Yeah.
Well, yes. Well, I don't wear hats in restaurants because if I did, people would might think they were it was me. But I did love having hats for bad hair days when I was growing up and when I was first in New York before I became a restaurant critic. And, of course, I have a collection of hats that I wear to hide my face when photographers are taking pictures. Over the years, as a critic, I felt it wasn't right to expose your face, and to be anonymous as long as possible was my goal.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, you're known for. I think you're known for both. You're known for your bags and your hats.
Nobody has ever recognized me by a bag.
No, but now I'm online, maybe. But yeah, the hat is definitely a signature style of yours.
Right.
So, okay, here are a few more. How about fried peanut butter and banana sandwich? Love it or hate it?
Well, how do you know that that would be my thing?
I don't know. I read your book.
All right, I just tweeted that. I was reading about butter on a bun in the New York food section today.
Oh.
Something I've never eaten in my entire life. But I do love peanut butter, bacon, and banana on a toasted half of a bagel.
Yeah.
That would be a great treat.
Yeah, and I was thinking of the Elvis story or stories that maybe you have. So I know it's known as being his favorite. Okay, two more.
Well, you want to say that that Elvis, who featured briefly in my life in a flamboyant way, was also a great lover of peanut butter. And if you want to know the story, you can get Insatiable, Tales from a Life of Delicious Excess, and find out how it happened that I was the only woman in the hotel room when Elvis came in between shows in Detroit, Michigan.
Yes, people, go buy the book.
Lucky, I guess.
Very lucky. Okay, two more. Cheese plate or dessert?
Cheesecake or dessert?
Cheese plate.
Oh, cheese plate or dessert. Well, I don't know. I think I would certainly love a cheese plate, but I don't want to give up dessert.
Okay, you can have
usually
both.
Usually the people at the table, if I say let's have one dessert, they want a dessert.
So,
a great cheese plate is actually a wonderful lunch or dinner.
Yes. Last one. Well, yeah. Okay, last one. Manhattan or Brooklyn?
Well, I hardly know Brooklyn. Manhattan is my place. And anytime anyone has a car and wants to drive to Brooklyn, I'm usually game. But most of the time, I'm not going to spend an hour in a round trip. And you're much more likely to find me in some wonderful new Manhattan restaurant.
Great. Well, you're excellent at the game. I loved your answer. So thank you. Now we're going to talk a little industry news. I just picked out the New York Times review today. Pete Wells reviewed this restaurant in Flushing, Queens. He gave it 3 stars, and the article is titled "A New Kind of Sichuan Restaurant in New York." And this place is called Guan Fu Sichuan. I never heard of it until I read this review. I think it sounds amazing. I don't know how he discovered it. Gail, have you heard of this place? Do you have any interest in going?
I would like to go tonight.
Okay.
Quickly, before it's impossible to get a table. 3 stars seems a little rash, but if he says so, I think it would be it could be astonishing to have that experience. We go to Flushing once in a while and try out new places. So, but I never heard of that one. And good for Pete Wells for finding it.
Yeah. So, do you tend to go? Is what other reviewers, the places they're reviewing, does it influence at all where you're going? Or is it, separate?
Well, in this case, he would. He very rarely reviews anything that haven't already been.
I know, you're very quick.
So if he really loves something, I'd certainly trust him. And occasionally we love the same things. So
okay,
that's a proof of something. I guess it's a proof that there is a quality of taste that people who are good tasters share.
Yes, I agree. And the other article, I just had something I found on NPR entitled Sharks Meet Chefs, Discovery to Buy Scripps, Acquiring Food Network and HGTV. If I said that right. So this is about how Discovery Communications, which owns Discovery Channel, Oprah Winfrey Network, and Animal Planet, is acquiring Scripps Networks Interactive, which is the Food Network, Cooking Channel, HGTV, and Travel Channel. And so the two companies, they're going to command nearly 20% of ad-supported pay TV viewership in the U.S., and the deal was $14.6 billion, and it said it was going to, that Scripps was in debt of $2.7 billion, so it's going to help with that and reduce costs.
Well, interestingly, I'm having dinner tonight with a executive from Scripps, and I was going to talk and find out more about this.
All right.
I would love it if they would celebrate by giving a big donation to City Meals, because after all, a lot of what they do is about food. I don't know, did you say 14 million or 14 billion?
14 billion. I might have said it wrong.
Yeah, that is hard to think about, wrap yourself around, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a lot.
you can still buy an ice cream for only $20.
Right. Yeah. No, it's a big merger. And so, yeah, you find out more of the scoop at your dinner.
Yes, I'm going to find out what that's all about.
In Queens, perhaps.
Apparently, joining and taking over is happening a lot in the medical business, in the pharmacy business. You buy some small company's genius and make it your own and mm-hmm. profit from it. And sometimes it's scary because you feel there will be less competition. So I don't know what this is. I'm going to definitely ask tonight.
Okay. You ask and let us know. And on that note, we're going to take one more break. I'm going to come back and do my solo dining experience and have Gail give us the final question. So stay with us. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
Like what you hear? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. With fresh programming every week, we've got something for everyone. Trying to start your own food business? Concerned about where your food comes from? Looking for the best wine or beer to bring to a party? Find our shows on iTunes or Stitcher, or head to heritageradionetwork.org to listen live and subscribe to our newsletter.
Welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer. It's time for my solo dining experience. This week, it's at Sushi Ishikawa. Here's the rundown. The location, 419 East 74th Street, Upper East Side, New York City. The concept, innovative omakase serving top quality sushi with genuine warmth and hospitality. The chef, Don Pham, formerly of Oya, Geisha, and Geisha Table. So why did I go? Because I love sushi, and I love Chef Don's sushi, and he is a client, full disclosure. And I believe in my 150 episodes is the first time I'm doing some solo dining at my client, but for good reason, because it's a really special place. So here's my experience. I arrived for a 6 p.m. seating, and I was warmly greeted by the team. I was seated near Chef Don at the sushi counter, and the omakase progression began. I savored every bite with delight as I watched Chef Don work at his fast pace and with his fun personality. He moves so quickly with perfection, it's actually hard to keep up with him just taking photos. I don't know how he does it. So what did I get? I opted for the 15-course omakase, which is $125. They also have a 12-course omakase for $85. Now, the omakase I had included pieces and composed dishes such as pen shell scallop, smoked Tasmanian ocean trout, a duo of Russian and Santa Barbara uni topped with black truffles, another duo of ebi, which is shrimp and white baby shrimp with portaga, and toro with caviar and gold leaves. Plus, it was a mid-course of shawanmushi, a fabulous hand roll to end, and refreshing melon for dessert, and I had hot green tea. My take: inventive, beautifully presented, mouth-watering sushi like no other omakase. Chef Don is a true master, in my opinion. The ambiance: intimate, refined, yet modest setting with an 11-seat sushi counter and 12 table seats. It's perfect for sushi lovers and also uni lovers because he serves a lot of uni, and anyone looking for a one-of-a-kind experience at a good value. Interesting tidbit. So Sushi Ishikawa is Chef Don's first restaurant as owner, and he named it after his dear friend and fellow sushi chef. Chef Don is Vietnamese, and he uses some native ingredients to make house-made sauces, such as kampachi viet. And my guest today, Gail Green, wrote a stellar review on her experience at Sushi Ishikawa, and you can check it out on her website, Insatiable Critic. And she has a photo there of a woman who was licking a bowl of uni trio with Ocestra caviar and talked about it because it was so good. This woman was not going to miss any part of it. So, personal fun fact, I had met Chef Don several years ago when I did the opening PR for Geisha Table, which is part of Serafina Restaurant Group, and that was an intimate Japanese izakaya and sushi restaurant on the Upper West Side, and he was the chef there. So the cost of the meal is $125, not including tax or gratuity. I was comped as a guest, but as I say next, would I go back? Yes, and I would be happy to pay for it anytime. The website is ishikawanyc.com. So, Gail, yeah, I know you had a nice experience there as well.
Well, I hope that when people are looking up my Ishikawa experience, they'll discover that I have on my website also a huge collection of vintage articles from New York Magazine. If you're wanting to know about what it was like and the snob restaurants in 1970 or the Four Seasons when the first time I wrote about it, all those, there have been more than a couple of hundred vintage articles on
gems.
My website.
Yeah, no, there's a
really
lot on your website.
I love reading those old pieces myself, wondering, oh, how was I so funny then?
Oh, you're such an amazing writer. I don't know how you week after week pull these stories together and all the details, and you're exquisite, your writing, and I think from then to now nothing's changed. So
thank you.
You're welcome. So it's time for the final question. So next week, my guest is Jason Wright. He is the founder of J. Wright Design, which is a New York-based graphic and web design studio for industries including restaurants and hospitality. So some of Jason's clients are Morimoto, and he works with John Fraser at Nick's and Dovetail, and he also works with the Culinary Institute of America. So Gail, what would you like to ask Jason?
Well, I'd like to know if he can enjoy food and where he would go in a place that is shabby looking and not fabulous and he had nothing to do with. What would that place be?
Great. I will ask. I like that question. And on that note, that's the end of the show. So thank you so much for joining me, and congratulations on your amazing career. It's really inspiring and just very impressive.
Well, thank you. And thank you for letting everyone know more about City Meals and that I'm still alive and eating.
You're
eating
definitely.
And loving it.
You're
had
definitely.
Some great discoveries in the last month, and they're all on my website.
Yeah, and I noted it a little before, but you are very quick with new restaurants. I think you get your views out, but you beat everyone else time
well,
and time
I
again.
Well, I try to do, when I do a review, it's at least two or three visits. But many of my articles are first impressions because I'm so excited about a new place that I want others to know and go there and keep it alive.
Yes. Well, that's wonderful. So thank you again for joining me today. I will let people know how to find you. So my guest today has been Gail Green, the insatiable critic and former restaurant critic at New York Magazine. Gail is also the co-founder of City Meals on Wheels with James Beard. Her website is insatiable-critic.com. Her Twitter is at Gail Green. That's GAELGREENE. And Instagram, Insatiable Critic. You can find me at Sherry Bayer, at Bayer PR, at All Industry. My Facebook page is All in the Industry. My websites are BayerPublicRelations.com and SherryBayer.com. And all of our shows are archived at HeritageRadioNetwork.org and on iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks again to my guest, Gail, and today to my show's engineer, David. I'm Sherry Bayer. Happy 150 episodes. And thank you for being part of All in the Industry. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.